Several people have mentioned this already, and it's true. Everything that we do about this is true. We have been standing on broad shoulders all these years. We've been standing on the shoulders of Dr. Tenbrook. We've been standing on the shoulders of Dr. Jernigan. Many of us are standing on the shoulders of Dr. Maurer. We've been standing on many shoulders all the time, and sometimes we've been doing that even though we didn't know we were doing it. We've been standing on those shoulders, and parts of our lives have been a reflection of that. People have come to understand that, and for those who didn't understand it, I just suggest you might want to think about the reflections of the panel that you're going to hear from in the next few minutes. So for whatever this panel cares to produce for us, I give you the moderator of the panel, Mindy Jacobson.
Sunny days, secret up, clouds away.
I'll just never forget when he played that thing for me. I was just so shocked. Okay. I am crazed. I can't stand there now. That's so much better for me. Okay. What I would like to talk to you about today is standing on broad shoulders. My premise in this discussion is going to be that many of us, and particularly those of us who are younger, and when I was younger, I fit right into this category, are pleased with the work that we've done, and we have done good work, but we're not aware of how that happened. My premise is that many of us who did good work could not have done it without the National Federation of the Blind having done the work that we did, lo, these many years ago. And you've heard it before, but let me just say that in 1940, if a blind person could get $20 a month to live on, that was a great deal. I mean, people were getting $20 a week to live on, and Social Security for blind people was $20 a month. The National Federation of the Blind started with 17 people, and they had an awful, awful lot of work to do. When they got started, the things in their day were so very different. There were so many fewer opportunities, and the opportunities that many of us have today were doors that were opened by the Federationists who have gone before. And make no mistake about it, friends, this was our work. It was our organization. We need to take ownership of it and believe it, because this was our organization. We did it, though it was our ancestors and probably many people who are no longer with us. But to begin this, I'm gonna ask Wilbur Webb to talk for about 5 minutes about what were things like back in the early days, the real early days. What were some of the differences? I know we couldn't go to the city colleges and that kind of thing, but he'll know things from his own perspective, and Wilbur Webb is carrying some of the broad shoulders on which we stand. So I give to you now for 5 minutes or so, Wilbur Webb.
I'm going to take the soul, not 5 minutes. If you heard Laura this morning, I don't know how she got into my room to steal my papers, but she read my speech off to you this morning, so I'm not going to repeat that. And she shared that with Peter Crawley, too. He sold part of my speech, so I'm not going to repeat that. So I'll go through a few biographical things that has happened in my life. I'm a graduate of Batavia School for the Blind. I'm proud of that. It's like going to a rich man's boarding school. There I took up tuning. I also took up poultry. I was going to be a chicken farmer, I thought. And but I did have an academic regents education at Batavia. And after that, I went out into the world and thought I was going to be the richest man in the world. And you found out that that's not true. And I read in the The Ziegler, that's Romeo's paper, a good magazine. You know, all your people should be signed up for it. About the beginning of the ESAB, and I joined part of that for the original 100 people.
What did that stand for?
And
what did that stand for?
Empire State Association of the Blind.
Okay.
And then we changed when I think it was Dr. Jernigan wanted us to have a common name of National Federation of the Blind, that we changed it to National Federation of the Blind of New York State. And my first thing about that was in 1957, Dr. Tenbrook came to Syracuse. But prior to coming to that, he called me on the phone and says, I want you to go over to the law library and get all the library books concerning the blind in New York State. And I thought to myself, law library? Where the hell is that? And so I did find out. I went over, didn't know what I was asking for, and brought back an armful of books for him. He brought to Syracuse about four other lawyers with himself and laid out a plan for us to attack the different discriminatory laws in New York State. And you heard about the one about the university. There was also one that you couldn't teach in New York State unless you were other than blind. And Pete Roydell was a big mover of that thing, and he went around the state, and we got that law passed. And that was, like I said, about 1958, 1959. And not knowing that would be helpful to him, he graduated from the Buffalo State University in 1968, 1969, and became a teacher himself. And along that line, Pete also moved to Sullivan County, and he saw a need for a library there for the general public, and he and his wife, with another small committee, set up a library, and that library has been very successful and has been incorporated into the school district down there. And Pete, a blind man, totally blind, has been given that credit for doing that. He also started something that was unusual, and that was a photography contest. And so in 2 weeks, we're going to go down, and I think this is about the 13th. Pete has been gone for about 12 years. So this has been about 15 years of participating in a photography contest. Dr. Tenbrook also said that we're not looking for preferential treatment. We just want fair treatment. And that's what I hope that we're all doing. And a couple other laws that we worked on in 1968. Everybody knows who Dr. Lewinson is and the little fight he had with jury duty. And he and Dr. Tenbrook got together and settled that in New Jersey. We took it up here in New York State, and we had that passed in the early 70s. And I myself have been a juror on a trial, and so was my wife. So, and probably many other people here now have taken advantage of a law that we saw to fruition. I'd like to tell you about one thing. I'm a trained masseur, and I worked at the YMCA in Syracuse, and I applied for my job, walked in blindly, and was very receptive to me. Didn't know that I was blind until I got there. And he showed me around. He says, how are you going to handle this? How are you going to handle that? And I gave him satisfactory answers. And one of the difficult things was there's about 13 lights, and they were about 15 feet up. And all they had was a string you had to pull. Now, how was I going to handle that? I told him I would. And I did, by standing on a chair for 15 lights. And I also was supposed to check the steam room and the hot air room, and I did that. But I had to, he said, make sure there's no bodies live or dead in there.
How did you do that? Go around and touch stuff?
Pinch them. I guess my 5 minutes are up.
Okay, I appreciate that. Now, so Wilbur's are some of the shoulders that we've stood on. And he did a lot of things, and the people in that time did a lot of things that he's now continuing to benefit from, and that we will too, as you see as we go on. There's a switch on that microphone, Wilbur, if you want to turn it off for a couple minutes so that the battery doesn't die on that. Okay, thank you. All right. And the person who is going to be speaking after me is Dennis. So if Dennis will be making his way up here. Dennis, just so you don't have to stand up here for nothing, what I'll be talking about toward the end of what I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to take the longest time, I beg your pardon, but since I got a chance to moderate, I'm going to tell a story that I think is a great story, and then I'm going to tie it to what I really mean to say about all of this. And I'll be talking about Betty Friedan and the women of the 70s when about that time you want to come up. Okay, Dennis? Thanks. Oh, all right. Well, you got a while to wait. when I was very young, I began to do what it is that I found myself doing for most of my life, which is blazing trails. I always found myself wanting to do things that other kids hadn't done before. And that lasted throughout my life, and I attribute it mostly to my parents, who will come into this discussion at a later moment. But I wanted to be a teacher of tomorrow, they were called in our schools. They were future teachers. The sixth grade kids, some of the sixth grade kids who wanted to be teachers would get the opportunity to go in and take a first grade class and just babysit for them for 15 minutes while the teachers took a break. And at first, the answer was absolutely that I could not be a future teacher. And I was so upset, and I did what Peter said this morning. I didn't take no for an answer. And when I went to the principal's office and asked her about it, and she said, "No, I'm sorry, we can't let you do it," I said, "Well, I knew because I had had experience with the superintendent before. I had told him some off-color jokes because I didn't know at the time they were off-color because I was in kindergarten and I knew he'd remember me by then. So I suggested that I could talk to him, and the next day I was invited to become a teacher of tomorrow. But my problem was that they put me in a room, and it was only two girls to a room, but they put me in a room with two girls who were already assigned, so I felt that I was the third wheel. But I didn't want to be a third wheel. So when the kids were coloring, I had them humming and singing and began to get programs up with them. And by the middle of the year, the teacher stayed out for a half hour. The other two kids went up to their class because they had to after 15 minutes. And when the teacher came in toward the end of the year, we put on this program for her. And she liked it so well, we ended up putting it on for the whole school. So I thought I was quite something, and I really thought that I was a great kid. Well, then I went to high school, and in my school, you had quite a bit of free time during the day, which you were supposed to use for studying, but I thought it would be a great thing if I could be an intern, like the college interns in school, and to intern in the school for the in the public school where they had a resource room for blind children. And I just thought this would be the greatest thing. So once again, I went to the school board, got permission to do it, and got a chance to do that through my senior year. And I thought I was really quite something. And then I went in college. I decided I wanted a job. Well, I had been working for my father, may he rest in peace, because he had a business in Florida. How could you not give your kid a job? But he was a tough employer, and I wanted somebody who would be a little easier. So I went to the something like the State Commission for the Blind here. It was at that time called the Florida Council for the Blind, and I went to them, and I said, "I want to work. I'd like to work." My mother came along with me. She was always my advocate, and she came along with me, and they said, "Well, you know, well, let us see what we can do." Well, after they got me a job teaching swimming in one of the public pools in Miami, they started a whole program. And the next summer, tons of kids got summer jobs. I thought it was really quite something. I was working with 5 or 6 year olds, 5 and 6 year old sighted kids. Oh, yeah, couldn't tell me nothing. But then I went to college, and it came time for my internship there. I was majoring in music education, and the school sent my mother a letter. I didn't even know about this. One day she called me, and she was in the motel that was nearby the school, and she said, "Well, I'm here. Want to come and join me for lunch?" And so when I got out of class, I went and joined her, and she told me she'd gotten a letter from the school saying that I was not going to be allowed to intern because they had had a blind student there before, and that person had failed in her internship, and they just felt that although I was a good student in general, I wasn't going to make it in the classroom. And so I said, "Well, can I come with you?" And she said, "No, this one I'm doing on my own." So she went in, and I actually said to her, normally I would tell you that not to worry about this because I already knew that 6 months later I would be here in New York. I had decided to move here when I was 21 years old. I hadn't been allowed to move to the city before then, but I wanted my independence. I wanted to be able to travel freely when I wanted to go someplace without having to worry about getting a ride there. And so it was just my form of wanting to be independent. And so I had gotten an agreement with my mother anyway that I was going to move, but I said that I was involved with this organization. Some guy had come to the campus and tried to start an organization. He told me to call him Ken. And he gave us all these records to listen to with speeches and stuff. But I heard him talking, and I thought, you know, he's kind of older, and he'd probably already let life pass him by pretty much. We're talking about 1972. But he influenced me quite a bit. I actually was the recording secretary of the chapter. And so I said, because of that, I'm going to let you go and do this because maybe somebody else will want to intern down the line. So at that point, very slowly, NFB was coming into my life because after that six-month period, I moved to New York City and began working for the JBI. I don't know if you remember the Jewish Braille Institute, but you might remember Jake Fried, Dr. Fried. He was my boss, and he would always tell everybody who came around to visit, "This lady's going to be a cantor." I mean, when I was a little kid, I used to sit and hold the cantor's hand in the assemblies, and I thought, gee, I'd like to be a cantor. But, you know, that was a man's job, and it wasn't anything I was going to be doing. So when he said that, I sort of laughed. But we had a problem with an entertainer who was supposed to be at one of our functions. So he asked me to entertain. It was a month after I had moved to New York, and the next day he asked me to a meeting, which I later found out was to be a luncheon meeting, but I thought I was in trouble. I said, "Oh, my God, I've been working here a month. It's my first job. I'm in New York City, and I'm going to get fired." But instead, the JBI offered me a scholarship if I would enter cantorial school, and so I did. And it was a very, very interesting situation. There were only 3 women in the school ahead of me. The cantorate had been a job for men. Men were all there was. And so 3 women were ahead of me. We didn't know if any of us would make it in the field. And there was a great deal of discrimination. In fact, as I sat waiting for my audition, one of the cantors, and actually he was one of the composers in residence, came in, and he said, "We have had somebody here before, and he wasn't doing a good job. I don't think, considering you're a woman and you have to go through this curriculum, it's not going to happen. I am going to vote against you, and I'm sorry to have to tell you that, but you might as well know what's going to happen before the interview." But I, you know, I can't do no that easily, so I did the interview anyway and was accepted on the spot. And I entered my first class the first day, and there were 9 men and 3 women in the class. We had pretty small classes in those days. And the instructor decided that he was going to do a service for us. Now, it takes, you've got to have 10 men or 10 people there to do a service. In those days, it had to be 10 men in order for the service to be, you know, kosher, so to speak. I guess in my mind, I figure God's listening anyway, but, you know, I was just a kid. I didn't know. I still believe that, by the way. But anyway, so he looked around the room and he said, there's only 9 men here. Well, I guess 3 women will make the man. He actually ended up being one of my strongest advocates in the end. But, you know, it took time. And I was certainly encouraged through the whole thing by Dr. Fried, I have to say. And I wasn't a member of NFB at this point, but I would do all of the publications. In fact, during the 73 convention, I was responsible for all of that brailing that needed to happen. And so I was very aware and later on understood that I was being encouraged in many ways by Dr. Tenbrook, who was already, of course, passed on, and certainly Dr. Jernigan, though they really didn't have any contact with me. I certainly felt the influence of Betty Friedan and Katie Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, for sure. But my sense was still that I was doing this all by myself, really. And I got a chance. I had the greatest experiences. I got a chance to travel all around the country as a cantor, a guest cantor while I was in school. I thought that I wanted a position as a cantor, but I should have realized, listen, I would travel to these various cities, and I would be treated like a queen. They would pick me up at the airports and usually nice cars like limousines. I got to ride in Rolls one of the times. And I would go immediately to press engagements. So I would speak with the newspapers and the TV stations and radio stations so that they would get to know what a cantor could do for their community. And particularly in this case, what a woman cantor could do. Because the school had to place us. And so they had to send somebody around. And lo and behold, it was me. My colleagues were not being sent around the country. It was just quite an amazing thing. And I just knew that I was great. I'll never forget one place I went to. And this is even hard for me to say. They wanted me to change clothes for each of the various engagements that I was going to. And so there was a woman who was assigned to me who would run my bath and take my clothes after I took them off and wash them and freshen them up so that the next time I wanted those, they would be ready and there would be a new set of clothes at my choosing waiting for me on the bed when I got out. And at night, I had a bell that I could ring in case anything went wrong. And at the end of the time, the woman who was taking care of me, I guess you would call her, a lady in waiting or something. I know they call them valets for gentlemen. And she wanted me to sign her autograph her slippers. Now, I have to tell you I couldn't go that far. I just couldn't do that. So I wrote her a note saying how much I appreciated everything she had done, and I signed it. So I was hoping that was good enough. But it was quite a thing. I would go in, I would do these press engagements, and then I would officiate services on Friday night and Saturday morning, and then do probably a concert on Saturday afternoon, and they would have a big reception. Almost everywhere I went, there'd be a big reception for me, formal wear on Saturday night. And then on Sunday morning, I would teach the children in the religious school, and that way they would find out what a cantor could do to them, for them, to them, too. It was a financial responsibility, so I guess you could say, too. So I really thought, and I remember people saying to me, you should join the Federation. You think like Federationists and everything. And I would say, I don't have time. Why didn't I have time? Because I was so busy being great. I finally got out of school and had a congregation and all that. And It was a really wonderful and successful career. Right now, I like to do too many things during the weekends, and your weekends are pretty tied up when you're in the clergy because you just have to be there. And I have rather enjoyed the work that I do during the weekends and my travels with the Federation. So I have chosen not to stay in the field. But my last trailblazing thing was with the Sweet Adelines International Choruses. There was a chorus in Brooklyn, and I started out as a member, and I promised myself that I would not get into leadership because this was just going to be a fun thing, and I was going to stand on the risers and be Susie Singer, just member. And I was seeing someone at the time who said, in 2 years, you'll be running the thing. And he was absolutely right. 2 years later, I was the director. But the funny thing is that when I left Florida State, they told me that I should not, under any circumstance, try to be a conductor or a director because they felt that a blind person just could not do that. And I had a very hard time with those classes, so I sort of agreed. But my chorus asked me, and when our original director was going to leave, and I said no because I don't think I can really do it. I really believe the rhetoric. And this time it was the organization itself that said, why don't you give it a try? We'll try it if you'll try it. And my members said, I said to them, well, I'll do it, but I won't take you to contests. I'll let somebody else direct. I'll teach you. And they said, no, 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 no. If you're going to be our director, you're going to be our director all the way. And I had a wonderful experience with that. I've brought them to 3 first place titles, and it was a really wonderful, wonderful experience. Now I don't want the responsibility, and I'm singing as a member again and really having a good time. But, in fact, my friend who was my assistant director is now my director, and now I'm her assistant, so it works out really nicely. But the thing is, what occurred to me somewhere along the line, really, while I was working at the JBI in like early 1990, the thought occurred to me that my success was not my own. I understood, after having come to several national conventions, that it wasn't that I didn't do these things. It wasn't that I wasn't the one who made it possible for myself, but really, what it was is that somebody had created an atmosphere in this country that made it possible for blind people to go out and give things a try. The people who started it out in 1940 had a much harder time than I did. Much, much harder time. But for me, I had an easier time. And why? Because there were so many people who made it possible that somebody would listen to me when I said I wanted to be a cantor, that somebody would listen to me when I said, well, I'll try to direct this chorus. That would not have happened, I promise you, in 1940. And so what I'd like to do is let you hear a few more stories of people who are aware of this now. And believe me, friends, the battle is not over. It is not. You'll hear from a couple of people in just a minute who are still fighting battles and who, as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, had a terrible time getting themselves listened to. Let's start first with Dennis Holston. Dennis, if you'll come up, can do you have a microphone? Yeah. Good. Dennis Holston. Yeah, I thought you had a traveling mic.
Well,
here.
I do, but you can hold on to it. All right. I like this better anyway. Okay.
Because you're too tall.
Oh, okay. Hello, folks. Okay. Well, I'm here to tell you about a little bit about my story. I'll try to make it as brief as possible. And considering I didn't say that. When I was born, At least I think I was born. I might have been hatched. But I came into this existence with congenital glaucoma. Basically, I was born blind out of the left eye. And I still had sight in my right eye. We had some difficulties throughout my childhood with the right eye, but I still maintained sight in my right eye until I was about 11 years old. And then I had a detached retina. Now, they went back and they did surgery, and lo and behold, I began to get my sight back. I started to see things again, you know? But then it happened again, thanks to a blood clot. Now, this totally changed the path of my life. You know, before the retinal detachment, I was just running the streets like any other kid. I mean, I was the only one blind out of one eye, but, you know, my right eye was good enough where I could run with the boys in the streets and jump fences, ring doorbells and run, you know, act up, you know, hang out late, get home too late, get spanked by my mother, the whole nine. I'm just a deviant, that's right. But when I went blind, when I went totally blind at 11, it changed the course of my life. I wasn't hanging out in the streets anymore as much. You know, a lot of people, you know, were kids, they kind of backed away a little bit. And of course, it goes both ways. I backed away too. And I developed many different interests. One of them, I had already had the interest of teaching. And when I went blind, I just did not believe I could be a teacher and be blind. How do you be a blind? I understood the concept of what we used to call resource teachers. You know, you go to a class once a period, and they sit with you and they deal with you on a one-to-one level. But I wanted to be a teacher of maybe 30 kids in a class, like I was brought up in mainstream public school. I didn't think you can do that, being blind. So now I'm blind. And I had a couple of other interests. I had to find something to do with my time that I wasn't in the streets anymore. So I turned my attention to politics and music and so forth. And I developed this great interest in being political and this great interest in community building and this great interest in music and other forms of entertainment. So I set out to start going about those various different goals because I just believe if you want to do something, you go ahead and do it. Maybe it's scary. Maybe it's a little bit fearful. You can hang out in your fear for a little bit, but after a while, you just got to swallow it up, man up, and move forward. And so that's what I did. I started out 18, 19 years old doing different work in the community. I started volunteering. My whole life is built on volunteering. I went to different switchboards where you would call and you'd have someone listening to your problems. Yeah, one of them was me. Probably the youngest switchboard operator there was, 18 years old, listening to other people's problems and trying to help them through it. I started doing that. Different organizations I became part of. I just did a lot of groundwork. Community organizer, I guess I was building up to be.
A community organizer.
So I guess I was one of those evil community organizers in the beginning. And as I moved forward, something came to my attention as I was doing some community organizing, a word of mouth of this organization. And the NFB, what is the National Federation of the Blind? What do they do? I heard it, you know, it was a word of mouth, and I heard about it. I'm like, all right, I'll go to a meeting. You know, I wasn't doing anything else. I was going through a rough time in my life, and I was homeless for a time period, so, you know, dealing with housing and being homeless and moving from place to place and staying in shelters, oh, what fun. So I was bouncing back and forth and doing different things, and I decided to go to the NFB, a meeting in the NFB local chapter in New York City. And there was these blind guys doing work in the blindness community, and I was like, this is interesting. Let me sit and listen and see what they're about. 6 months later, I was running for the New York City Board of Directors. And soon after that, I was in Albany advocating, speaking to legislators. And I'm like, well, this is really new. This is great. I like community organizing. I like I like benefiting people who I can closely identify with. And, of course, being blind is one of those things. So I started to grow in the organization. And I started to, you know, I was part of teams, and a lot of times I sat in the offices and I just listened. I stayed quiet, you know, and while all the big boys talked. And I learned from them. And they were my mentors in a way. And I learned the procedures of law. It increased my knowledge of politics and the political procedures. It increased my ability to advocate for the community. And as I became more and more involved, then I started going to national conventions. Then I'm like, national conventions? It was a big week of lots of activity. Everything was going on all at once. And I had so many interests. Which one to go to first? I was trying to be a teacher there. I got to be a computer teacher, so I started going to the National Organization of Educators, and then I found the Performing Arts Division. Oh, look at here, the Performing Arts Division. So, as time went on, I started to grow with the organization. And I also pursued things outside of the organization as well. I'm currently working in different adoption agencies and so forth as a mentor to young black teens in the inner city, which is one of the things I like to do. And also my work with the NFP continues to grow, and I continue to benefit from my roles here at the NFP, learning about the political procedures, learning from the people that came before me, and hopefully I can benefit people who will come after me. And now I get to run a division of performing artists, something I always wanted to do. Thanks to my role there, I got my current job and where I'm at. Thanks to my training and my mentors here at the NFB, I got to work on a couple of political campaigns. I got to talk to a lot of legislators and advocate in other different organizations, and it was really a beautiful thing for me to come across the NFB and learn so much from the people that came before me, and hopefully the things that I've done will benefit people that will come after me. And it's been a wonderful experience, and I was called upon to share my brief experience with you, however, you know, good it is, and I thank everyone for listening.
What a life. I got two microphones. This is the epitome of, yeah. Okay. So that was Dennis's story. And I think you'll see that there's a pretty common thread here. But a story of a different kind is going to be told by Kate. Kate, you want a mic? You can just stay where you are.
Sure. I have
Kate Mendez.
Hi, guys. I have a sort of an antagonistic relationship with microphones. I tend to hold them too close and then, or too far away. So if you can't hear me, just scream. It's okay. Someone's practicing in the back. When Mindy first started talking about standing on the shoulders of other people, I got an image in my head of a picture that's in my photo album from eighth grade. A much skinnier version of me is standing at the base, is kneeling at the base of a pyramid of preteen girls in a park. And it was a picture that we took when we went on our eighth grade picnic. And as I was thinking about standing on shoulders, and I was thinking about the amount of coordination and scrambling and negotiating and teamwork and group work that went into getting us all stacked up like that in that pyramid to take that picture, I started to think about the fact that we don't just stand on one or two pairs of shoulders. We stand on a lot of pairs of shoulders. I'm a public school teacher in the New York City schools. I guess I like pain and suffering because, you know, and it's not a job you go into for, you know, fun and kicks. I teach this year, 23. I got a new student on Thursday. 23. General ed, sighted kindergarten students in the South Bronx, and I love them and they're wonderful. But to get into that career, I needed to have a lot of layers of support, people to stand behind me and under me and around me when I was growing up and learning to be an adult and learning to be a teacher and learning to be a self-advocate. if you look at my life and you look at the structure that has allowed me to become who I am today and to do the job that I do, at the very base are my parents, and they're not here today, so they're, you know, nobody tell them I said this because it'll pad their ego, but my parents are both
God
blind. My parents are both blind. They're both successfully employed, and they did not play. When I was a kid, it was you will be age appropriate, and you will be respectful, and you will do your homework, and you will be successful academically, and we don't take any excuses, either yours or the school district's, and this is the deal. They were the keystone of forming my personality and making me crave success and crave high expectations for myself and for others, and without them and other blind parents like them, I wouldn't know how to be a blind adult in charge of children, any children. You know, my parents were the ones that I said to someone today that my parents were psychic. I mean, my parents, even though they were blind, knew everything we were getting up to and showed me how I picked a very good pair of ears and an instinct for trouble will allow you to manage any group of kids. They all, you know, other blind parents that I met through my, you know, associates of my parents taught me that if you've got students who are runners, you can put a bell on the door. Well, in their case, it would be children who are runners, but if the concept applies to my classroom, you can put a bell on your door if your kid likes to sneak out, which is incredibly useful as a teacher of kindergarten students who on the first day of school, at least once a year I'll get a kid who thinks they can sneak out and go run and find mommy. And the bell on the door is a good way of catching them before they're gone, which I wouldn't have known if I didn't have blind parents who knew other blind parents. So that's the, you know, the foundation level of my being, knowing that I'm able to do the job that I do. It's above my parents in the pyramid, not above them in influence and respect, but are the successfully employed blind adults, many of whom are in this room, the people who showed me just by living their lives and setting examples that you can be a successfully employed blind adult no matter what people tell you and no matter what people say and no matter what kind of manure you have to wade through to get a job. Those people have been tremendously influential in my life, and I'm very blessed to have known many of them. And to keep this really short, because I know it's getting late, at the top of that pyramid are the people who kicked down doors, the people who said, no, you can't tell me that I can't do this job. You can't tell me that I can't be a parent. You can't tell me that I can't engage in society as fully as I want to. Because when I started going to job interviews, I got the most impertinent set of questions. Well, how are you going to manage kids? How are you going to do? And someone actually asked me, how are you going to be, why don't you just go teach at the school for the blind? That'll be easier. And if I had not seen as many strong, powerful, self-advocating adults, blind adults in my life, I would have given up. I came very close to giving up, even with all of those, all of the support and all of the structure and all of those positive influences and examples, because after the 12th, 13th, 14th interview in one of the most school districts and most desperate need of teachers in the country, and after being refused time and time and time again, only the presence of those people in my lives who had already kicked down their own doors and were standing behind me encouraging to kick down the ones that were blocking me, that's the only thing that really kept me going. So we stand on a lot of shoulders. It's not just a few. And they come in at, they come to us at so many different points in our lives and in so many guises. So for me, I want to say thank you to the people in the room who have been the shoulders upon which I've stood. And I want to say to the people who are maybe at the convention for the first time or coming to be adults and striking off out of your families and setting up your own futures, this is a place with a lot of shoulders. This is a place with a lot of hands to hold you up when you fall down. So stick around. It's worth it.
Keep your microphone, Kate. I'm going to ask you one question, I think.
Fire away.
Okay. How many interviews did you go on before you got your job?
14, and I was hired on a provisional basis. They made me teach with a co-teacher for a month to make sure I wouldn't, drop a kid off a cliff
so
or something.
So they put another teacher in the classroom with you, right?
For the first month, and then she, God bless Mary Fitzpatrick, wherever she is, because she went to the principal and she said, this is absolutely not necessary. She's fine, and I want to teach ESL, which is what you hired me for. So leave me alone and leave her alone. And he said, okay.
That's great. That's great. And I want to ask you another question. When you got into the classroom, were you asked to have any extra paras or anything extra after that month? Were you asked to take on anything else, a second situation that other teachers were not asked to deal with?
I was asked to have a paraprofessional, but this is sort of a double-edged coin. I teach kindergarten. Many of the kindergarten classes in the New York City public schools have paraprofessionals. So in that context, I did not feel that it was discriminatory. Now, this should be interesting because next year I'm going to be asking my principal to move me to an upper grade. I love kindergarten. They're wonderful children. But if I have to tie one more pair of shoes or deal with one more child screaming for mommy for a month at the beginning of the school year, I need a break. They're wonderful, but I want to go to an upper grade. And it'll be interesting to see what my principal says about that, because I have a feeling he's going to have my para, who is a lovely person, but she's a para, and kindergarten teachers have paras and upper grade teachers don't. I think he's going to want to have her come with me, and we're going to have to fight that battle across that bridge when we come to it. But that's for May.
Right. And you know you got a lot of support on it. That's great. Thank you so much. And one more person I have, Katie Carroll. Kate, wait, no, I'm not. We're not done. We have Katie Carroll, and I want to just say that Katie is one of our scholarship winners this year, and I would like you to say some of the things that you told the scholarship committee in your letter, Katie, because I found out that she was a little unsure of what she needed to talk about. So just go with what you're planning, but include a couple of the things that you said in that letter, because that's what we need to hear.
Hey, hi, everyone.
Hey.
I'm Katie. Whenever I give people my name, they always ask, like, they ask for my last name if they're looking for me on a list, and I go Carol, and they're like, your first name, please. Or no, I'm sorry, your last name, please, and do that like three times. I'm 20 years old. Again, I'm a junior in college, and I was born with ocular albinism, so I'm very blonde. And I have not as blonde as you, definitely not. I have a decent amount of usable vision. I did not start using a long white cane regularly until about a month ago. I'll get into that. Why I started using a cane a month ago. I graduated from the Sachem School District in Suffolk County on Long Island, it's a really big school district. My graduating class was 1,200 people, and we had just been divided up into two high schools then, so I walked with about 600. But it's a really big class, and I was the only visually impaired person in my class. So that was a really lonely experience for me, because I did not have anyone to basically model myself after. I was basically relying on myself all throughout school. Okay. Yeah, I think to a lot of people in high school, I was just that really blonde girl that couldn't see so well. I had my fair share of experiences with teachers that, wouldn't, be as helpful as they could be and things like that. And my attitude about my blindness throughout elementary and high school was just one of tolerance, nothing more than that. I didn't even accept the fact that I was blind. I was just like, okay, I'm different, and I can deal with it, and I'll do what I have to get by, and I was successful in school. So it's not like I had to, I was constantly struggling. So that worked well. But then I graduated and I got older and I started to have some really great life experiences, such as the first experience I had with the NFB when I won my first New York State scholarship, and everything kind of went uphill from there. I think one of the first person I spoke to from the New York affiliate was Ray Wayne. Is that true?
Probably right.
Yeah, I think that's true. And that was just so incredible for me because, again, I didn't have anyone to model myself after, and I always thought that I wanted to go to law school, and finding out later that Ray successfully completed law school and everything like that is just like, wow, it's just amazing for me. This past summer, I was a national scholarship winner in Dallas, and this was kind of the culmination of my change in attitude about my blindness. When I went through this huge transition from tolerance when I was younger to acceptance, and then now a full embrace of everything in my life, and not trying to hide the fact that that I'm blind, and kind of wearing that part of my personality and life proudly. In Dallas, I got to meet a lot of really strong professional blind people, and it was just amazing. Other lawyers, people that wanted to be doctors. I found the other scholarship winners to be just so incredible and very inspiring. Just meeting other college students that wanted to do incredible things was a real breath of fresh air for me.
So, Katie, let me ask you. So now you use your cane all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you found a difference in the way people are relating to you now? Because now they know. Before they didn't know. Is there a difference? Does that make a difference for you?
Well, when I came back to school, I had people running up to me going, oh my God, what happened to you? Like, what happened? Like, what is this thing? I had people, when I went back to my martial arts class, people wanted to know, did they miss the memo? Were we supposed to get something so that we could start learning kendo? Or like, what's going on here? Even my really close friends, it was kind of a surprise to them as well. When I was moving all my stuff back in for the semester, and I had put my two canes in the corner, and a friend came to visit. She knocked on my door, and she's like, what are those? And I was trying to be funny, and I said, those are my ski poles. Like, I'm a really avid skier. I don't know if I ever told you that, but she actually believed me. The reason why I use my cane now is because I made a really good friend in Dallas, another scholarship winner, and he's totally blind. I actually wrote about him. And he really encouraged me to use my cane all the time, even though I have a lot of usable vision. And it's been a great help to me.
That's great. Thank you so much, Katie.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you. So all of these people have realized, and that's why I wanted them particularly, because I knew that even if they didn't realize that they would, in thinking about it, that they had stood on a lot of shoulders. In my case, now there are women in both the rabbinate and the cantorate. In fact, they're 50% now women. And I hope that to whatever extent is possible, people will be able to stand on our shoulders, all of us standing here, mine certainly, and I hope that young people will feel comfortable coming to us and using us to stand on. And I say to the parents who are out there, we're here. Don't forget that we're here. And when you have trouble, don't feel that you're alone, because you're not. Fortunately, we have a National Federation of the Blind, and we've got lots of experience, and we can help. So don't be afraid to ask. That's why we're here. To everybody else in the room, I say, unfortunately, there are still barricades. We need to get to the top of them. Let's climb to the top of them together, and let's not come down until blind people. Are you okay?
I'm fine.
Okay.
Not so okay.
Well, the chairs, you know, they're hotel chairs, you know. but let's get up on those barricades together and stay there until blindness is no longer an enigma. It's often said by both presidents sitting to my right here that the future is ours. And I say it's our responsibility. Let's dream it. Let's shape it. And let's build it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm a little prejudiced, but wasn't that a great... we go... Other affiliates do an item towards the end of their day called Why Am I a Federationist? You've heard that story before, and I think a different title was just chosen, but you just heard four stories about why they are federationists. Or five, I lost count. Five why I am a federationist stories. At any rate, I really want to say that the stories that were told today by all the speakers embody who we are, why we are, what we are, and we wouldn't have the success unless we were able to allow each other to stand on our shoulders. We didn't get there alone. We recognize that, and to the extent that people haven't recognized that yet, you will in time. We are the blind of the nation. We've made the advancements because we care about each other, and we know what we want, and we will get there.